Natalie Olson. Today is Friday, May 6th, and we are in the home of Miss Carol Jarvis. Carol, thanks for having us today, and we're going to get started with a little bit of your background. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
Yes, I was born in California. I was actually born in Los Angeles, if you can imagine, but that was way back when it was a little city, nothing like it was, and my folks lived in Anaheim, and that's where I grew up. But anyway, Mom was in Santa Monica when the birth came, so she had to go to the county hospital. This was in the Depression days when they didn't have money. But anyway, I had a really good home life. I have one brother who's since passed, but no ranching background. But my father always wrote poetry. He always had a poem for any occasion, like my mother's birthday, our birthday, wherever he worked, if there was something going on, he would write these little poems and everybody would call him the poet of the whatever job he was working for. I had wonderful parents, you know. Didn't know how lucky I was, I guess. We didn't have monetarily very much, but we had the love. And I always loved the outdoors, and I was always out in Anaheim in those days. There were orange groves and Japanese gardens where they sold produce. And I stayed there, graduated from high school in 1952, just turned 17, and worked for a while for an insurance company. And then when Disneyland came along and Walt decided he was going to put that just a few miles from my house, and I applied for a job and went to work at Disneyland the first day it opened. It was so exciting. I mean, you know, the dignitaries and Walt and all the people from Hollywood that were there. And of course, all us young people that were working there, we were all gaga over, not like they go gaga today, but, you know, in a more subdued manner. But it was fun. And I worked there for about a year, and then I got itchy feet and decided I wanted to do something else. For some of the things that were going on at Disneyland right then. And so I took off and went up to Yosemite and worked there for the summer and a little bit of the fall, and enjoyed that, really enjoyed that. And I met a girl who was, like myself, just kind of adventurous. And she said, "Have you ever been to Jackson Hole?" "No, but I always wanted to go." "Well, I'm going to go up in the summer. Do you want to go?" Of course I wanted to go. So I went with her, which back then I didn't have a vehicle. And so we went up there, and I worked at Jackson Lake Lodge, got a job up there, and she did too. And we just thought it was the most beautiful place we'd ever seen. And then she was going to go home in the first of the fall, but I didn't want to go. I wanted to see Jackson Hole in the fall, but I didn't have a vehicle. But it didn't seem to matter at the time. I don't know what I was thinking about. But I went to work for the fall hunting season for a dude ranch up there in Moose. And, oh my, what an experience that was. One of the other girls and I had this little log cabin. And if you know what chinking is, it's in between the logs to keep the air and the cold. And, well, it didn't. I mean, good God. We were so cold up there, the wind would blow, and we had a wood stove, and neither of us had a clue how to start a fire in the wood stove, so all we did was sleep in our clothes and with a blanket around us, you know. But it was an adventure. Anyway, when the season was short, because it was just the hunting season, and it was time to think about how I was going to get out of there, I didn't want to spend the winter up there. So at the little town of it wasn't a town, little store at Moose, I'd gotten acquainted with the man that owned it, and I told him my problem. I said, "I need to go south, but I don't have any way to go. Do you know anybody that's going down?" Well, he did. One of the old-timers there, an old lady, was looking for someone to help her drive to San Diego. Well, I was right on my way to Anaheim, so we made a deal, and I drove her, and on the way down, she had friends in Nevada. I can't think of the name right now, but he was a naturalist, and they were studying the bighorn sheep in Nevada. And what an adventure that was again. We got to go out with them and see where they were working and how they were trapping some of the sheep and putting collars on them or whatever. Then we stayed with them a couple of days, and they were wonderful people. They had three little kids that are by now probably mothers and fathers and the rest, but the kids were just fascinated with my story, which wasn't much of a story, but they, what are you doing? Oh, you go out by yourself? Oh, you did this? You know, I mean, and I thought, well, okay, I'll tell them. And that kind of got me into telling stories. But anyway, I got down as far as Anaheim, and which isn't all that far from San Diego, and I told her I would be glad to take her clear down to San Diego because I'd driven the whole way. And she said no, she was fine. And so we said goodbye, and off she went, and I was home. And then I bought a car. I've been saving my money, so I bought a car. And from there, I went to Luff's Cab and got a job for the winter. And I was a server, you know, served food in the dining room.
How did you hear about Wickenburg?
An ad in the paper. My mom saw it in the Los Angeles paper. And she said, well, what do you want to do this winter? I said, I don't care. Well, I could do anything. I just want to travel and see places. And she said, well, here's some ads. It was Lost Cab and Flying E. Both had an ad in there. So she said, why don't you go see what it's all about?
And what year was this about? And what year was this about?
That was 1956. Yeah. So I went over and I thought, which one of the, I read the brochure they each had, and I thought, which one of these do I want to work for, Flying E or Lost Cab? I don't know what made me pick Lost Cab. I really don't, because I didn't know anything about either of them. But I went in and applied, and they hired me right then. And so I went to work there, and it was very laid back as compared to what it is today. It wasn't laid back like you might think, because it was still, you know, the elite of the Wickenburg, not lodges.
Dude matches.
Thank you. I told you these words are there, but they don't come. But anyway, that's where I met the girl that stayed with me in my little cabin. We just hit it off. She was from North Dakota, and she had worked for the ABRA, which was the North Ranch that Dallas Camp had. And so she said, well, I'll go down to Arizona and work for this winter. And he said, fine. So anyway, we were roommates, and we got along just great together. And so she said, where'd you go last summer? I said, Jackson Hole. Oh, she said, I've always wanted to go to Jackson Hole. I said, I have a car now. Do you want to go this summer? She said, oh, yeah. So when we got done at the Dude Ranch here, we took off. I mean, we just drove. It was hotter than Hades. You know, by the time we closed up the lodge and did everything, it was May. And I don't think I had any air conditioning, because all I can remember is that we were dying down here in the heat. But anyway, we wandered around and camped out on the way. You know, we had sleeping bags, and we'd see a spot and go throw our bags out. You couldn't do that today. But we did, and we never, ever had a problem, and we met lots of nice people along the way. So we got up to Jackson Hole, and I didn't want to go back to work for the lodge. I could have, but I wanted something different. So we worked a couple of different places, just like serving or waitressing or something like that. And then we found out there was a job at this Ed Hodgson's, what did he call it? It was where they had the tables out under a cover, but they had a big wagon, and it was served with beans, and you know how they do that, and the tourists just
like a chuck wagon style.
That's what it was called, Ed Hodgson's Chuck Wagon. And it was right on the highway going to Moose, and between Jackson Hole, Jackson and Moose. So we went in there and applied, and you could always get a job if you worked, so we got work there. And then I said, you know, we better find a place to live, because we had a motel part of the time to go clean up and all, and the rest of the time we just camped out. And so we had a friend from, I had a friend from the year before, and I went to see him, and I said, you know, we could get a little cabin or something to live in for the summer. And he said, well, it's kind of rugged, but I know where there is one. And talk about rugged. It was at the back of this guy's little place, and it was an old trailer. You wouldn't even know it was a trailer. I mean, it was probably built in 1920, and he had all his stuff stored in there, and I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be interesting. He said, if you want to clean that out, it's got a bed in the back, and it's got a little wood stove. I said, does it have any water? Well, see that creek out there? You have to bring it in from that. I said, we'll take it. He didn't charge us anything. Oh, I would tell you, we worked our tails off to get that stuff out of there and cleaned it up. And, of course, we had the one bed in the back, so she and I both shared the bed, which wasn't all that comfortable. But, you know, when you're young and you're having all these exciting times, you don't worry about things like that. Anyway, we'd go to work at Ed's and then come back, and there was a beautiful meadow out behind this place with aspen trees, and I had a little Chihuahua dog that went with me everywhere I went. And so when we got home, I would always change my clothes and take him across the creek and go just for hiking. And so I was out there walking along, and I thought I heard something clonk, clonk, clonk. Next thing I know, here's this cowboy on a beautiful black horse, and he had a big cowboy hat on. He had those tall boots with his pants stuck in, and I thought, oh my God, I'd always said when I was a kid I was going to grow up and marry a cowboy and have a ranch. Well, we never had a ranch per se, but that was the cowboy that I ended up marrying. But it was so funny because I had put on my little shorts, which I never wore out in public, but I put on my shorts and one of those tops with elastic that you put on to cover your, you know.
A tube top.
Yeah. And I thought, oh my God, I felt like just throwing my arms up in front of me, because I was embarrassed to be out in that, and here's this guy, you know. But I guess he was quite impressed. So anyway, we talked a minute, and he was working at the ranch at the end of the road where we were. And he said he also worked at the rodeo in Wilson every Saturday night. And was I going? Well, I didn't even know there was a rodeo, but I said, well, it would be nice, I'd probably go. And he said, well, when I get through working, you know, there's a bar there, and you want to have a beer? Oh, that would be nice. The fact that I hated beer was not going to be anything I was going to tell this good-looking cowboy. Anyway, that was the start, and we got where we were dating, and that was for that summer. And when I got ready to go, he said, I would like to get married. And I said, no, I'm not ready to get married, but I'm going to go back because I wanted to come back to Wickenburg. I had a couple of jobs I could work at. And he was going to be guiding. He was a big game guide up there. He was going to be guiding that fall. And I said, we'll talk when you get down out of the, you know, the forest. So anyway, I had a lot to think about. Because believe it or not, I mean, I thought he was the greatest thing, but I didn't know if I wanted to settle down. I was having so much fun the last few years just going and seeing. And that's true. Once you marry and you start a family, that's all gone. But anyway, he came down when he got done. He came down when he got done with the elk season. And my girlfriend and I were living at Simpson's. They had a little apartment, and we were living there. And so he came down. and he brought his brother, and they'd both cowboyed for years up in Colorado and Nebraska and all, and he said, I think we should get married. And I finally thought, I guess maybe that's what we should do. And we were married in the chapel of a little Presbyterian church right there in Wickenburg, December 20th, 1957. And Dan's brother, his name was Gene, he asked Angie, my girlfriend, to marry him, but she was Catholic, so we couldn't have a double ceremony. And so they were married January 10th, just that long after we did. And so she's my sister-in-law, my good friend. And we're still buddies. She's in Riverton, Wyoming, and her husband's died too. And so we're both widows, and we're both still trying to be as independent as we can. It gets harder as you get older, and you've got these physical things to have to deal with. But I still have a little adventure left in me.
Now, I want to back up for just a second because you said something that was interesting. You said when you saw this cowboy up on his horse, you knew you always wanted to marry a cowboy and have a ranch.
Yeah.
But you grew up in a non-ranching family.
Absolutely.
So can you tell me how you came to, did you have a love for horses early on?
I did.
And cowboy?
I did.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Right. When I was growing up in California, my mom used to laugh. She'd say, I don't know where you come up with all these animals, because back then, I went out, even when I was little, I always was looking for something. I didn't know what I was looking for, but I liked to be out in the country, and I would bring home a dog, a cat, a gopher one time, believe it or not, and I found people who had horses, and I didn't know anything about it, but I loved horses, and through the people that had them, they taught me to ride. Now, I certainly wasn't an experienced rider, but I could saddle a horse and understood a little bit about it, and I loved it. I loved it. I thought, oh, that's what I said. Mom, I was a little kid. I'm going to grow up and marry a cowboy and have horses. Okay, honey. All right. Yes, you do that. So it couldn't have been too big a shock when I called her and said, I found my cowboy, and he wants to get married. I don't know that they thought it was such a great idea, because neither one of us had anything. He had an old International pickup, and I had my Ford wagon. You know, when you're young and dumb, you don't have a clue. I mean, we had no idea what we were doing.
It sounded like it was fun, though.
Well, it was, and we were married 53 years.
So when you guys were first here in Wickenburg, can you talk about some of the local activities that you participated in, or what did you guys do?
Didn't participate much, because he was busy with that Simpson Ranch all the time, taking care of the cattle and doing. Plus, he was a horseshoer. That's the main thing that he made money on to pay our bills. He was an excellent horseshoer.
So when you guys got married, you lived at the Simpson Ranch?
Uh-huh, yeah, yeah. And he was such a worker. There would never be a time when he couldn't do something, because that's the way he was. Whether he was shoeing horses, trimming trees, working with cattle, breaking colts, anything like that that had to do with the ranch life, he did. And 7 days a week. My traveling days were over after getting married, because right off I got pregnant. And that Dan Lee that you met, and she was born right here in Wickenburg, and Dan didn't like the desert. He spent most of his life up in the high countries of wherever he happened to be, and I said, you don't like the desert? No, it's dry. I like to see the green, and I like the river running. And so anyway, he had a little piece of acreage there in Jackson Hole, and he said, I want to go back. Well, since I was pregnant, I didn't want to go somewhere. I didn't have another doctor, and I knew what we'd be living in would be probably a trailer out in the middle of nowhere with 4 feet of snow, and that's what it would have been. But anyway, so we stayed here till I had my daughter, and she was old enough to travel, you know, 3 or 4 months. And then we bought a trailer. It was about 38-foot trailer, and hooked on to it with Dan's old International, and off we went. I was in my Ford Falcon or whatever it was called. I don't know, it wasn't a Falcon, but anyway, had my daughter in there and everything that we had, which was not much, I can tell you, not much at all. And we headed up there, and when we got there, it was still winter as far as I was concerned. I think it was April, and indeed there was 4 feet of snow. Yeah. And it was off of the road. Of course, they plowed the highway there that went by it, but nobody plowed going into where this 2.5 acres was back on the Snake River. And I'm thinking, well, they had to get a cat to get the road open so we could get in with that trailer, and then they had to push the snow away so we could get the trailer in on the acreage. Gosh, I'm thinking this California girl in Jackson Hole in the snow country. I was already cold. But anyway, that was an experience that I could tell a lot of stories about. But Dan made it work because he built a little thing on the outside of it where you could come in and knock the snow off before you went into the trailer. But just one little thing I'll say, our bed was in the back of the trailer, and then I had a little bed in the middle where Danalee, my daughter, place was, next to the little tiny bathroom and the little tiny kitchen with one place to sit. And this is how cold it was. We were in the back, and I think it went down that spring like 25 below or something, which wasn't too bad because the next winter it went to 40 below. But we were in the back, and I was cold, and I went to pull the wool blankets over me, and I couldn't pull them. And I'm pulling and pulling, and Dan said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm trying to get the blankets up. I'm cold." And he took a hold and like that. They were frozen to the wall from our breath. Had made enough vapor that it froze the wool blanket to the wall. Now, if you think that was a winter, no wonder I'm down here in Arizona. But anyway, that was...
How long did you guys stay up in Wyoming?
About 2.5 years. I got pregnant again. I finally figured out after that what caused it, but that was where Laura, my youngest, was born, in Jackson Hole. In fact, I think she was one of the first babies born in the new hospital there. That was in 1960. And so we, again, had a lot of adventures in that little trailer. But in the meantime, Dan had tried to find, he was working on, they put a new bridge in across the Snake River where we were, and on the other side to go to Jackson. And when that was done, there was no work. I mean, it was still middle of winter and there was just nothing. Well, he'd get out and hustle and find a few things, but nothing that was really making any money. So he finally said, "I guess you're right. We better get out of here and go south where we can." So we did. We were lucky enough to sell the 2.5 acres with the trailer in Jackson Hole on the Snake River for $8,000.
In the middle of winter.
No, by then it was not river. That was after winter. But that little piece of ground now, God only knows what it would be. $800,000 probably, literally, because that Jackson Hole's gone like that. But so we, here again, packed up what we had. We had two horses, and Dan had a racks on the back of the, was covered racks on the back of his pickup. So the horses went in there, and again, I had everything else we had, which again wasn't that much, but now I had two kids. So we headed south, and we were getting ready to go, and the neighbors were saying, "Oh, where are you going to go?" And we said, "We don't know, we're just going south." And Dan took this snow shovel, and he put it on the front of his pickup, which had a great big thing they called a cow pusher or something, you know. And the guy said, "What are you going to do with that?" He says, "I'm going to leave it on there until I get far enough south that somebody says, what is that shovel for? Jeez. And we had, I know you don't have time for all my adventures on the way back down there, but it was interesting. My whole life, and I think back on it, is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
But then we eventually bought a place. There was, it's nobody knows it unless you're an old timer here, Bowman's Barn out on Highway 93. And we called it the Prescott Highway then. But we found a place right next to it, north of it.
Did you just come straight to what you came straight from Wickenburg then?
No, no. We went, actually, we went through California and looked at a couple places, one in Susanville, and then went on down. And in the meantime, we had friends up there in Susanville. I had a friend. And they said, well, we've got a place for your horses and stay a couple nights. Well, they wanted to take us to pizza. I don't care that much for pizza, but I thought, okay. And I was so tired from the trip and getting ready and the two kids and the whole thing. So we went to pizza. And their daughter, who was a teenager, stayed at the house and took care of my two little girls. And we went out and had pizza. I ate one little piece of pizza. Everybody else thought it was great and ate it. We all got food poisoning. And I mean bad food poisoning. They finally, this next morning, they had to call a doctor. They called the doctor for me. It was the one that ate the little tiny piece was the worst sick. But I was, you know, I think I was worn out, and that's why it really hit me. But we had to spend 3 days there then until I was well enough to even sit up and drive. And then we went to my folks in Anaheim, and from there we came over to Wickenburg, and that's when we started looking for a place to buy.
What and made you decide to come back to Wickenburg?
Because we had been here, and we knew people, and we liked this area. And so we went and looked up Luke White. He and his brother were realtors then, and they showed us a couple places, and then they showed us this 20 acres out on the highway. And it had a little house and corrals and right on the river, so you could take the horses right out the gate. And, of course, the river being dry most of the time, ride the colts and leg them up and because of the deep sand. And we just decided that's what we wanted to do. And so we took our little money that we got from that and put it on that down payment on that place and worked our butts off for the next 20 years making payments till we had it all paid off.
So how about some of the most memorable people that you've met when you were living in Wickenburg?
That was on that other sheet, and I was trying to think of who. I'll just tell you about my friend, Ruth Courtney. They had the stables as you went out of town on the left. Well, it's actually where they've still got all those horse trailers now, and they put people up. That was their stable then, and they rented horses. And Dan and I met them when we were riding our horses sometime down there, and she became one of my very dear friends. She just passed away a few months ago at 93. And we used to have just good times, you know, but they worked hard just like we did. We didn't have a lot of time to do anything except work, but that's what it took to make the thing stay together so we could. I can't think offhand. We weren't that social because, like I say, we were so busy all the time. Dan was shoeing horses when he wasn't rebuilding all the corrals and the barn and hauling rock. He took rocks from down below where the river was and put them in a wheelbarrow. We didn't have any equipment, and pushed them up a slope to get up where the house was, and then put like a big circle out in front with cactus and that, all by hand. I can't believe it. I mean, he was a very strong man, but when I look at the work that he did there and what he did in Wyoming, plus all the places before I married him and knew him, and then this place out here, I'm just amazed that one man could get that much work done. Anyway, that's I can't really think of anyone that I... Bowman! Oh, old Everett was right next to us. And one time, he was a character, I'll tell you. We would buy calves at the sale in Phoenix, bargain calves. Or we'd buy horses and bring them home and, you know, see what they were going to be, and sold quite a few horses. One time when Dan was on the Caballeros ride as a wrangler, he counted 13 horses with our brand on it, because we branded the M Lazy T on the thigh, left thigh. And so he'd go around with all the horses. Hey, that's one of mine, you know. But anyway, Everett was a mule man, among other things. But we had bought these calves, and they weren't healthy calves, but most of the time we could save them and then feed them and take them back to sale and make, back then, if you made $30 on something, you really, it's hard for people in this day and age to realize what $30 could do for you. But anyway, I had this one calf. Dan was gone somewhere, cowboying for somebody, and I went out, and it was laying down, and I thought, oh, geez, it must be bloated. I didn't know too much about cattle either, but it did look like it was bloated, had a big hump on the side of it, you know, and I thought, oh, I know Dan used to tell me that he'd stick them when they were bloated. Oh, my God. My friend, and a friend of mine who is a good neighbor, had come over, and I said, we got to save this calf. I can't lose it. You know, we haven't got enough money to let it go. She said, well, what are you supposed to do? I said, Dan sticks them when they got that big hump like that. She said, I'll go get the knife. So she got a butcher knife that wasn't very sharp. But anyway, she got the knife, and I thought, okay, Carol, you can do this. You can do this. You can puncture it. I took my hand, two hands, and I'm thinking, okay, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm going to do it. And I raised up, and I went, crunk, like that. And the thing just, it didn't go anywhere. It didn't get through the hair. It was so damn dull. I mean, it came back, my hand came back, and then I looked up, and Bowman was right looking over his fence at me. And I said, Everett, you know, what are you doing over there? Well, I was going to try to stick this calf because I think it's bloated. And he said, well, why would you do that? I said, well, to save its life. He said, that thing's darn near dead now. You could stick it and it'd never do any good. And, I mean, he didn't offer to help or anything. You know, just the dumb girl, woman over there didn't know what she was doing, which is true. But I was trying, you know, I thought I could do something. But later on, the calf did die within a few minutes. He was on his way out anyway. But I felt so bad because I hadn't saved it. And Everett said, you couldn't have saved that, even if you'd have been able to use that knife. And he's looking at this dumb butcher knife that could hardly cut anything. But anyway, that was my experience with Everett. I could hear him over there many times yelling at the mules, cussing at the mules. Man, I would hate to have been a mule that he had, you know, really. Anyway, that was one of my adventures back in those days.
So is he the one that had did he have the barn where everyone would come to the dances?
Yes. Yeah, and that's another thing. Every Saturday night he'd have those wild dances, and we didn't go. I mean, we were so tired, believe it or not, from working all day. We didn't want to do that. But the noise, because our bedroom was here, and then the corrals, and then Bowman's barn right against our fence. Ha-boom, ha-boom, ha-boom. I mean, you'd be trying to sleep, and it'd shake the house. It would, believe it or not, it was that loud and all that. And I'd think, oh, my God, Saturday night again. You know, it went on until 12, 1 o'clock, you know. And they'd yell because they had a bar in there and get wild and crazy.
So you guys never went to a dance in Bowman's barn?
No. No, Dan didn't dance. And I, like I say, I had things I was doing.
So let's talk about your poetry. When did you first start writing poetry?
When I was a kid, because my dad did. Mm-hmm. And I started writing poems. And actually, when I was still home, I had a couple of them. They weren't cowboy poems, but published in different magazines. Just little short poems that I'd send in. And
What inspired you when you were young?
Pardon?
What inspired you when you were young to write?
You mean the subjects or just... Well, it wasn't cowboys because I didn't know anything about the life or the ranching. But nature, I always was very interested in anything to do with nature. And then when I married Dan and found out about ranching and horses, I mean, really knew more about horses and breaking them and working cattle, then I felt that that was my niche and I had found it. And it was. I just fit in and learned and did what I could and started writing poetry way back then about the life. And I had my first poem in Western Horseman in 1969. And it was called His Only Son. And it was written during the Vietnam War. And they, over the years, they don't do much of it anymore, and I haven't submitted for a long time, but I think I counted one time, I had 15 poems over the years that Western Horseman published. And some of them were on their calendar, which, of course, I kept them because it's real beautiful big pictures. And then I started reciting when we moved to... Oregon. Let's see, that was in 1974. We sold out here and moved to Oregon. And I started reciting, not just writing, but reciting, because they had some cowboy poetry shows going on there. And I just loved it. I liked sharing what I could do and my stories of our life and that type of thing. And people seemed to really appreciated, and so I appreciated them and just began going to whenever I could get away and go to the cowboy gatherings, they're called. Mm-hmm. And we stayed there 17 years.
Were you seasonal, or did you guys sell out completely and go up there full time to Oregon?
No, actually, we sold three times. We sold to think of his name in a minute. We sold the house and 4 acres, but that was the last thing we sold, and we had divided the two pieces in front, 5 acres, and sold them at different times to help get paid off with the whole mortgage, which we did. And then we saved 3 acres. Dan built that down there. He went over the, I called it a hill, but it's a slope. And he cleared that off, got somebody in there with a big backhoe and a cat, and we bought a trailer, I think it was 12 by 60, and put it on there. And our plan was to go north and work in the summer and then come back and work, because he was cowboying for a lot of ranches around here when we lived there. And so that was a thought. But we found out before too long that was really not feasible. There was just too much to it. So we put that up for sale, and that's when my friend Ruth Courtney, she was a widow by then, and she wanted it so much because it was down, it was hidden, was nowhere near, it was quiet, you know, and she had it, still had a couple of horses. So we sold it to her on time, and she stayed there until she passed. Anyway, that was our ties were cut then. So
you guys went to Oregon, you said, for 17 years? You were in Oregon for 17 years?
Yes, yeah.
And did you guys ranch when you were up in Oregon?
Yeah, we had, well, here again, we bought this huge, old, two-story farmhouse that had been there for, I think it was built in 1916, and it had to be remodeled, not remodeled, but rebuilt practically. And there again, Dan just got in. He actually, among everything else, he put metal siding on that entire house, including to the top, the two-story, all by himself. Now, if you don't think that was a job, trying to get that, go up the ladder, get those big pieces and all, I don't know how he did that either. But that's the main thing he did was cowboy. But then he went to work for the Forest Service up there and was a heavy equipment operator for the road crew and did that too, which he enjoyed that. He hadn't done that before, but he knew how to run the equipment. And I think it was a little easier than he was getting to the age where the horseshoeing was, you know, taking a toll on his back.
Now, were your girls still school age when you moved to Oregon?
Yeah, Danalee went into her junior year, and Laura started her freshman year. So they both graduated from Joseph up there in Wallowa County. Beautiful, beautiful ranching country. And it used to be timber, but that was destroyed with all the, we won't get into that, you know, the government closed down things, but we spent 17 years here, our family of four. How many? I wanted to do my poem for you, but I have to think a minute. How many sunrises is that? How many hours of laughter and smiles? How much conflict and how much combat? Let me turn that off. I gotta think. We spent 17 years here, our family of four. How many sunrises is that? How many hours of laughter and smiles? How much conflict and how much combat? I hear the soft sound of the river outside, and it helps bring a calm to this night. One more time, I'll check every room, and then I'll turn out the light. My footsteps sound hollow. The walls seem to stare. I'm like a stranger in some other's place. And all that remains of what used to be are memories and shadows and space. And that was the way it was. The last night in that old house, Dan had gone, the girls were gone then. They had gone out on their own. And he was asleep. And I was checking every room, you know how you do, make sure everything was out and cleared and ready for the next day when we left. I realize now I left out some of the poem, but anyway, there were no rugs or anything, carpet, and I could hear my footsteps going through the old wooden floors like that. And there was nothing on the walls, the pictures and all were gone, and it was like the walls were just staring at me, and I thought, oh my gosh, 17 years, all the memories and things that go with this house. But I really didn't feel regret. A sadness, of course, for all that was going on, but it was a beautiful place. It was right on the river, the Wallowa River, and we had pasture and always had horses. And but it was a stepping stone, and from there, we had already bought this 40 acres here at Forepaugh, and we're starting to build it and, you know, make it into a permanent place, because we had been going back and forth for about 4 years up there. Dan would work there in the summer and cowboy, come down here and cowboy, and plus build this place up. So that was getting to be old too, moving the horses and whatever we had to do, and then trying to get the place so that would be okay in the winter time, because big old house like that. But that was just another adventure. Anyway, then when we sold out, we came here to Forepaugh and bought this 40 acres and fenced it all and put in the rock walls, and Dan built all the corrals over there, pipe corrals, and we always had cattle here. We had more land besides the 20. We had more land down the road. And it used to seem like it would rain almost every winter and we'd have spring feed. So we would buy a few steers, and then the last few years we would get some from Bob Thrush, who is a butcher, and he would put his cattle over here, and just because I like to see them mainly the last few years. But we haven't had the rains, so I didn't have any cattle this last year. But this is, of course, Dan said when he was building this, he says, this is the last place I'm ever going to build. And we knew it was because I've forgotten how old he was then, but in his 70s and still working, still doing, you know.
Do you have any poems about Wickenburg? Have you written poems specifically about the town?
No. No, I haven't.
How about some of the cowboy poetry events? Which ones have you attended?
Oh, my goodness. Prescott was probably one of my favorites. I did most of them from the time it started. It was about 26 years ago. And I did most of them in August. And then I did poetry in Oregon. And I actually did a couple in California when I was there. Nevada, I was at Elko 2 years as a featured poet, which was nice. And then, of course, Wickenburg.
Are there any particular cowboy or cowgirl poets that you admire?
Oh, I like Audrey Hankins because she's another ranching gal. And she writes from the heart, just like I do, and tells the stories the way it is. And there's quite a few I'd have to stop and think or go get my book and pick them up. There's people I've known now and done poetry with for 25 years, and a lot of them are like me. They don't do it much anymore because of health concerns. It gets harder and harder to... I didn't do Prescott last year, because I had just had back surgery, and it was just too much for me to go from place to place to place and walk. And
can you tell me about any of awards you've ever received for your poetry?
If you come over here to the end of the wall, you can see. Oh. Did you like a glass of wine or anything? These are some of my awards. Get the light. That's me when I was a little kid out on the desert in California. Okay, I've got Women of Achievement. Wickenburg BPW in 2005, which I was very proud of that. And I did a poem for them, and they thought it was funny, but I can't remember where I put it. And this was a Willa. This is one I was really proud of, too. That was my book, Time Not Measured by a Clock, which was a finalist in 2004 for the Willa Literary Award. And 2001, the Gail Gardner Award for Working Cowboy Poet in Prescott, Arizona. And these are just some of the things that role of recipients honor the Gail Gardner Award, and that was the same one in 2001. And there was Audrey, she got one too in 98. Tommy Thomas, he was such a good friend, and Carson Thomas, his son, is still in Wickenburg. All these others, Gail Steiger, I still know him and work with him. I did that last 2 weeks ago Saturday. I actually got up to Prescott and did cowboy poetry for the first time in a couple of years because they said I wouldn't have to go from place to place because it's hard for me to get up on the steps, you know, and like that. And
Okay, Carol, so why do you think the West inspires so much poetry?
Well, for me, it's the openness of it, the connection that I feel towards what America used to be. I mean, it's so much different than when I was a young woman. But I've always been inspired by wide open places and nature. And I think many people are inspired by it. That's why so many of them, even from the cities, come and want to share with what we have out, even in Wickenburg, you know. And it's just a very calming element to me to be out where there's nothing man-made. You know, you can just walk out and you can see blue sky or rainy sky, wind, whatever, and I feel a connection to my spiritual partner, if you want to call it God or whatever. I've always felt that, even from the time I was a young girl. And for me, that's important, to have that connection.
Let's talk a little bit more about Wickenburg. How do you think Wickenburg's changed since you first lived here?
Well, of course, it's grown. In the old days, when we were first here, it was, you knew almost everybody. You knew everyone that had a store. You just knew who they were and you dealt with them, because I know we seldom ever went to Phoenix to get anything. It was something we needed. We bought it here. And there was a camaraderie with the locals. And I can remember even in the old days, if we went out occasionally on a Saturday night or something, you'd go to the Bar 7 and then you'd go to the one across the street.
Twin Wheels?
Hmm?
Twin Wheels? Twin Wheels?
No.
The Gold Nugget?
No, the bar right across from Bar 7. You know, it's right across.
The Mecca?
No, honey, you're in the wrong spot. Right next to the... to the gas station, but there's a bar right there.
It's called the Mecca now. I don't know.
No. Shut it off and I'll look it up. Yeah. The La Cabana. And everybody knew everybody. Really, there was never, you didn't go anywhere that you saw a stranger, because someone would say, well, do you know Jim over here? No. Okay. Well, this is so-and-so. And so many times they were going to be dancing over at the La Cabana. And Dan didn't like to dance. He said, I got two left feet and then these boots, I can't even do that. So we'd go over there to see who was over at the other bar. And we usually just took our drink, whatever we were drinking, and walked across the street to the La Cabana. And vice versa, you'd go the other way. And there wasn't enough traffic. You ever had to worry about being run down. You can imagine just a car once in a while going by. And if it was somebody, they'd honk at you and wave, because I knew you. And I usually had a few dances, and Dan didn't ask anybody to dance because, like I say, he said he had two left feet and he didn't want to, but he'd visit with his friends and the other cowboys and they'd have a couple drinks, and then maybe we'd go back to the Bar 7 and give their glasses back, and maybe we wouldn't. They always had glasses from the other bar on either one of the sides of the street, but It was just a fun place. Of course, I live 15 miles out of town now, and I don't get in that often. I mean, I go in when I need to, but I'm kind of isolated out here, but I like it. I'm comfortable with it, and up till the last few months, I had dogs, and I had them put away. They were 15 and having a lot of problems, and sold my last horse 10 years ago, and no cattle this year because of the no rain, but since it looks like it's going to rain again, and if I get the grass, I'm going to get some more calves to put in here because I love it. I like to just look out the window and watch them eating. I mean, I guess that comes from my close to 60 years of being in the ranching part of it, and I love it. I'm very satisfied doing what I do. And still write once in a while, and not as much as I used to, but I can do it if I need to, if I get inspired. You know.
So what is it that keeps you here?
The fact that we built everything on this place. We picked it out, the land, put everything on here, and I see Dan's handiwork in everything. We put the blocks on this house, those sunk block. We did that all ourselves. And the porches, of course. And like I say, out there, if it was nice, I'd like you to go out and see all the corrals and things that he built out there, and the rock walls. And I just feel, I still feel close to him. He's been gone 6 years now, but his spirit still is here with me. And I'm just content, you know.
Do you have a particular favorite Wickenburg memory?
Lots. I remember when we first bought the place out there, that was a big step for us to go into debt like that. And it was exciting, but it was intimidating too, because Dan was going to have to do it on his own, shoeing horses and riding for ranches and things. And I wasn't working then, but I when the kids were in school, I did go to work for insurance guy. Oh, that name eludes me right now. But anyway, I worked for him off and on for about a year. And other than that, I just stayed home. And we had people coming and going all the time because we bought and sold horses. So I basically had to be there, you know, to show horses if someone came looking for one and Dan wasn't around. And he was, most of the time he was out shoeing, except for 7 years when he was our livestock inspector for this whole area. He went all the way to clear the other side of Aguila and up north. He was even, he went into Yavapai, because I remember he was, Coughlin's had a ranch up there, and he would inspect for them too. Lots of different places. And he did that, and still would shoe horses when he could on the weekend or whatever. So that was a busy time. What'd you say, exciting?
Just your most memorable memory.
Memorable,
something that sticks out in your mind, or your favorite memory.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it was a favorite, but when we finally sold and moved to Oregon in 1974, that was very memorable because we were leaving everything that we had built up down here on the Prescott Highway and leaving a lot of our friends and not knowing how, if we'd ever be back again, which of course we did, but it was many years. And then when we came back down here that one winter, and Dan said, I guess if we're ever going to buy a little piece of ground, we better do it now because prices were going up. And I felt, oh, thank you for saying that. I didn't say it, but because he hadn't said that he wanted to come back down here and start over again. But when he said that, then we looked and looked, and coming out 15 miles out of town was the best thing we could have done, because we did look at some small acreages near Wickenburg, but when I see where it's gone now and there's just subdivisions all over, I'm so glad that we found this 40 acres and could build it up. And it was, like he said, this will be the last one I ever make, but he had built places before I knew him.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about that we haven't covered?
I can't think of anything right now.
Do you have any other stories about ranching here in Wickenburg? Or?
No, because I was the one that stayed home and did whatever needed to be done while he was out doing his cowboying and horseshoeing and whatever else he was doing. I kept the books, as they say, you know, was no big deal, but I paid the bills and kept track of everything and knew if we were doing pretty good that month or if things were going to be a slim again. I'll do you a poem that I made. I wrote for Dan quite a ways back when he had been telling me about his life before we ever met. He cowboyed in Nebraska, and I don't think he was in Montana, but Colorado, different places when he was a young man, before he moved to Jackson Hole. And he was telling me about how he felt, and he loved the outdoors too, and he loved cattle and horses and being out and working like he did. He just loved it. So I wrote this poem after he had said that, and I said, "Do you like it?" He said, "That tells what a cowboy feels more than anything I've ever heard." So that made me feel good. There's kind of a satisfaction in the way a cowboy lives. Not the hard work and the danger, but the freedom that it gives. A man out in the open, seeing something new each day, where a handshake seals a bargain and folks still do what they say. Now, cowboys have no great desire for wealth or power or fame, just a warm bunk when the nights are cold and a good horse he can claim. A drink of smooth, fine whiskey, some tobacco he can chew, a pretty cowgirl he can court every week or two. He doesn't bother much with the life outside his range. His life's devoted to those cows, and he's never going to change. Politics don't interest him. There's no TV out there. He don't know what a caucus is, and what's more, he don't care. His mind is on the weather, how long the feed will last, getting those cows to a lower range when it looks like summer's past. Looking out for sick ones, he's both doctor and midwife, keeping tally, finding strays, all a part of cowboy life. And riders of the rangeland never worry much, hardly ever seem to die of heart attacks and such. So I guess it's mostly true that his wants and needs are small. Like a good old pard, he'll share his yarns when the work's all done in fall. And when his long day's over and his ponies turned out to graze, he's filled with satisfaction from the job, not what it pays. And he'll walk through the door of the old bunkhouse with his dog just one step behind, content with his life as a cowboy and the peace it brings to his mind.
Thank you, Carol.